WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Dexter Filkins, the award-winning journalist who has covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for the New York Times, said Filkins' new collection of short stories, Redeployment, is, quote, hilarious, biting, whipsaw, and sad. It's the best thing written so far on what the war did to people's souls. The stories in Redeployment are about Marines and soldiers trying to make sense of and survive in their two worlds, the war in Iraq and the home front. Clive was deployed to Anbar province in Iraq with the 2nd Marine Logistics Group from January 2007 to February 2008. He left the Marine Corps in the summer of 2009 and received his MFA from Hunter College. Redeployment is his first book. And Phil Klein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your book as well.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Tell us about the title of this book, what you mean by redeployment. I looked it up on the dictionary online, and it has, I think, several meanings.
Sure. It's, when you deploy a unit overseas and then they redeploy back home. So that's the most basic definition, right? And of course, the collection is very concerned, not just with the experiences that people have, but also the way in which they return to them when they come back. And of course, another thing about these wars is we have an all-volunteer military that ends up going back over and over and over again. So, my hope was that the title would function in a lot of ways, and that and it's certainly something that was very key on my mind while
I
was writing it.
Sure, because you were not redeployed over and over again. Others were.
Others were, and that's one of the things about when you, I think every veteran who got out midway through these wars, and they've been going on for a long time. One of the things that you think about and that you deal with is you're out, you're living your civilian life, and people that you know are going back over, and sometimes very bad things are happening to them,
and you feel guilty.
Of course you feel guilty. Of course you feel guilty.
Because you should be there with them?
Because you should be there. You used to be part of this community that was deeply involved in these wars, in this mission, in trying to, trying to make things better in those countries, but also people who were trying to ensure that their Marines or soldiers came back whole, came back alive, came back fine. And, you get out, you're no longer in a position where you can help out your buddies. You're doing the next thing in your life. And I think that's something that every veteran who gets out, who's gotten out during this time, has struggled with.
This is a book of short stories, a book of fiction.
Yes.
For you, was fiction the best way to help maybe you make sense of your experiences, but also help the readers understand what you and other Marines and soldiers have gone through?
It was the only way. This book is not, it's not thinly veiled memoir at all. I was drawing on my experiences, the experiences of people that I'd known, people that I'd talked to, as well as a lot of research. But writing fiction is the best way that I know to think about things, because you can put the ideas or the questions that you have that trouble you under stress and strain, and you come back with an idea about what it means to be a Marine, what it means to be a citizen, what American culture is, or what the violence that you saw meant, but then you have to put that in a story, and you need to make it realistic, and you need to make the characters real, not just the main character, but even, the sort of the minor characters who maybe you didn't think about so much. And the process of doing that exposes you to all the blind spots that you had. And it forces you to think really deeply about what that experience is and try and communicate it to another human being.
One of your characters says, you can't describe it to someone who wasn't there. You can hardly remember how it was yourself because it makes so little sense.
I think, he's, and that's one of the perspectives. I think that it's difficult to get a grasp on an experience that you're still inside of. right? I mean, this doesn't have to just be with war.
Sure.
I frequently use the example to talk about, you know, you're in the middle of a bad breakup. And, you know, we all, you go to your friend who's wise, who goes, okay, you're being insane, right? Like, let me give you some perspective. I think that any intense experience, it's very difficult to grapple with it. And, you know, a bad breakup is one thing, but going overseas, and especially some guys going overseas, losing friends, seeing horrible things, and just trying to deal with the challenges of counterinsurgency, which was, you know, Marines refer to it as a morally bruising battlefield, because the insurgency hides among the civilian population. You don't know, you know, the main weapon that was used was IEDs. It's not a clear enemy that you can define and fight against, and it's just constantly, for even at a very low level, a lot of very difficult decisions with huge consequences that these guys have to make and then live with, and so it's hard.
You served in, you know, towards the middle to the end of the war, and you were in Anbar province, and this was really during what we describe as the surge.
Yes,
I'm curious about why you wanted to go to Iraq or wanted to fight.
Well, the thinking began, the process for me began in 2003, actually, during the run-up to the Iraq War. I was in college at the time. I wasn't from a military family. My parents didn't serve in the military. My dad was in the Peace Corps, and I think they were a little bit confused because of me and my four brothers, the five of us, three ended up joining the military.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
You have five boys, you know, my early years are sort of low-stakes warfare constantly. but certainly a lot of respect for public service in my family, and it seemed like this, you know, really important historic moment in our country. And, you know, it wasn't up to me whether or not we go over, but I could sign up and try and put myself in a position of responsibility, and hopefully affect things for the better. And that's what I wanted to do. I liked the ethos of the Marine Corps, and I was also, you know, I was a boxer, I was a rugby player, you know, certain aspects of the Marine Corps and the kind of tough image appealed to me.
Well, I keep quoting from some of the characters in your book,
yeah.
But one of them also says, the weird thing about being a veteran, at least for me, is that you do feel better than most people. You risked your life for something bigger than yourself. How many people can say that? You choose to serve. Maybe you didn't understand American foreign policy or why we were at war. Maybe you never will, but it doesn't matter. You held up your hand and you said, I'm willing to die for these worthless civilians.
Right. I mean, and that character is a little bitter.
Yes.
But it's, I think sometimes you'll find this kind of weird disconnect or this idea about, you know, if you signed up, you must have been, you just underwrote every policy that was ever made, good or bad, right? And that's certainly not the case. You know, I know a guy, Adrian Bonenberger, wrote an excellent memoir called Afghan Post, who protested the Iraq War and joined the army, right? And, you know, he's sort of an outlier, but those people existed. And, you know, you join for a whole variety of reasons, but service is very deeply important. And at the end of the day, you know, when I was there in Iraq, everybody was trying desperately to fight a savage insurgency, right? And, you know, we didn't, you know, it wasn't up to us to go back in time and, you know, make Donald Rumsfeld plan for an insurgency. What we had was our share of the task, and the serious intent to try and make the best of a very violent and difficult situation, and a situation that was horrible for the Iraqi people who suffered under, you know, through that violence.
But you did put your life on the, you and others put your life on the line.
Right. And yeah, at the end of the day, you join the military. You're at the very least, you're part of an organization where everybody was willing to do that.
And you were a, what was your title?
I was a public affairs officer.
Right.
So I advised the general on media. I had a group of Marines who worked for me who were combat correspondents. If you've ever seen the movie Full Metal Jacket,
oh,
the
sure.
Joker, right, is a combat correspondent. I escorted media. It was in some ways it was a fascinating job because on the one hand I was responsible for trying to communicate things to civilians back home. I also ended up spending a lot of time with a lot of different types of Marines, soldiers, sailors. I ended up traveling to most of the cities in Anbar, most of the major cities in Anbar province. You know, I did everything from going out from with National Guardsmen or engineers and, meeting with Iraqi police to sitting in and on the battle update assessment briefs that went to the generals. And so you got this, in that job, I got a very wide angle view of a lot of the just incredibly diverse things that were happening in that province at that time, at a very critical time.
You had a piece in the New York Times a year or so ago where you talked about, these were your words, you had a mild deployment. And I guess by that you mean you didn't see combat.
No, no.
You saw the aftermath of combat.
Yes. I certainly, as I said, I was not, I wasn't an infantry Marine. I wasn't one of these really dangerous jobs. I was a staff officer. I certainly saw... I live near the one of the level 2 trauma facilities. So, injured Marines or civilians or insurgents coming directly from the battlefield would come to be stabilized there. Certainly
it'd be horrifying.
Yeah, about a month in, there was a suicide truck bombing outside our main gate in Habaniya, and you had so many just families coming in with these horrible injuries, and the surgeons were doing they were doing surgery on the floor because we ran out of trauma tables, and Marines are running around carrying stretchers or trying to give blood. So you certainly saw a lot of the aftermath there in particular.
Pretty gruesome scenes.
Right.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Phil Klei is our guest today on Radio Times, and he has a new book. In fact, it's his first book. It's a collection of short stories, and it's called Redeployment, and it's drawn in part from many of the people that he met as he served in the Iraq War. He was in Anbar province, January 2007, February 2008. I'm going to have him read a section from this short story after a very short break. Stay with us. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Obviously interested in hearing from the veterans in our audience. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Walnut Street Theater, presenting Arsenic and Old Lace, Broadway's classic comedy. Mortimer Brewster is worried that his lovely fiance won't understand his unusual family. Abby and Martha Brewster are known for their acts of kindness and charity, but Mortimer has learned that his charming spinster aunts have taken to relieving the loneliness of old men by inviting them in for a nice glass of elderberry wine, laced with arsenic and just a pinch of cyanide. March 11th through April 27th. Details at walnutstreettheater.org, Ticketmaster, or 215-574-3550.
Steve, let me ask you something. When you're hosting NPR's Morning Edition, how do you keep all those news stories straight in your head?
By listening. I don't pretend to know all the answers. My job is to know who to ask and how to ask them. At NPR's Morning Program, our job is to push for real stories, honest answers.
And you can listen with us on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, low-income schools succeeding where others fail, despite or maybe because of problems their kids face.
She said, we're living in our car and the batteries just ran out. I couldn't finish my homework. And that shifted the paradigm completely for me.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Phil Klei about his new book. It's a collection of short stories. In fact, his first book, and it's called Redeployment, each chapter with its own narrator. And it's about the experiences of his characters as they fight in Iraq and also what it's like for them to come home and experience what reality, what life is like on the home front. I would love to have you read a section from your title story, Redeployment. Probably needs a little bit of a setup.
Sure. So this is the title story is from the perspective of a character who was at the Second Battle of Fallujah, and which is was very intense urban warfare, and he's just come home, and it's about the process of him coming home and being back with his wife and trying to settle back into stateside rhythm. And so I just, I guess I'll launch into a snippet from that story right now. So here's an experience. Your wife takes you shopping in Wilmington. Last time you walked down a city street, your Marine on point went down the side of the road, checking ahead and scanning the roofs across from him. The Marine behind him checks the windows on the top levels of the buildings. The Marine behind him gets the windows a little lower, and so on down until your guys have the street level covered and the Marine in back has the rear. In a city, there's a million places they can kill you from. It freaks you out at first, but you go through like you were trained, and it works. In Wilmington, you don't have a squad. You don't have a battle buddy. You don't even have a weapon. You startle 10 times checking for it, and it's not there. You're safe. So your alertness level should be at white, but it's not. Instead, you're stuck in an American Eagle Outfitters. Your wife gives you some clothes to try on, and you walk into the tiny dressing room. You close the door, and you don't want to open it again. Outside, there are people walking around by the windows like it's no big deal. People who have no idea where Fallujah is, where three members of your platoon died. People who've spent their whole lives at white. They'll never get even close to orange. You can't until the first time you're in a firefight or the first time an IED goes off that you missed and you realize that everybody's life, everybody's, depends on you not messing up, and you depend on them.
That's Phil Klei reading from his new book. In fact, the cover story of his new book, a collection of short stories called Redeployment. I love that passage only because we are inside of his head. He's still halfway in the war, but here he is at the mall, trying on clothes in the changing room, and trying to sort of figure out how do you navigate through a mall.
Right. Well, an intense experience like he's been through, you have to recalibrate your basic way of navigating the world in order to survive, in order to function well, in order to do what you have to protect everybody else in your squad, right? And, you're part of this really tight unit that's trained together intensively, and, you walk down the street, you know where everybody is.
You see everything, right?
You see everything, right? The character at one point says, I could spot a dime in the street 20 yards away, which is something that a veteran of the Second Battle of Fallujah actually said to me.
Wow.
That I put in the book. And then you go back into your civilian life, and all those skills that were not just useful but essential, they're not helpful anymore. In fact, it's quite the opposite. And you have to figure out, now how do I navigate walking down the street?
And he says there, people don't know what it is to be at orange, which I guess is this alertness that you have to have when you're in combat or the
yes.
potential for combat. Everyone's at white, just living their life.
Right. Just the sort of basic assumption walking down the street that no one's trying to kill you, right? Which is a perfectly normal assumption to have if you're walking through a mall in Wilmington, North Carolina, and it's a deadly assumption to have if you're walking down Fallujah in 2004.
There's a tiny little moment where this character, he's flying in, he's coming home, and he gives up his gun.
Yes.
His weapon, and he doesn't know what to do with his hands because he's been holding this weapon for months.
Right. It's
a little thing, but it says so much about what that experience had been for him.
Right. It's part of the basic gear that was always with him, that always had to be with him, that he depended on, not just sort of in a kind of intellectual "I need this" way, but also just sort of instinctually. It felt like a part of him.
He, you know, is looking forward to seeing his wife, Cheryl, and he sees her sign, and they meet, and they're driving in the car, and it's both, you know, it's awkward, and it's loving, and it's heartfelt, yeah. And as a reader, you feel the, you know, how do you restart a relationship? How do you begin?
And they're both trying.
They are, very
you know?
Much so.
It's he's been away for 7 months, very hard experience. She's been, you know, living her life and going on without him and handling things that he hasn't been a part of. And, you know, she cares for him very deeply and he cares for her. And yet, you know, they can't just snap back into their old roles because they're not the same people anymore.
They don't know each other in the same way.
Exactly. And so it's this kind of very delicate negotiation that they have to work out.
In fact, they, you know, when they make love, she's sort of scared.
Yeah.
She's, I mean, because she doesn't know who she's dealing with in a
way. Right. And he thinks to himself, I bet a lot of the wives felt this way.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Phil Klay, our guest today on Radio Times. I should spell his last name. It's Klay. And just because it doesn't sound like it reads.
It's confusing.
It is confusing. And we're talking about his new book, a collection of short stories called Redeployment, each chapter with its own narrator. He spent a bit more than a year serving in the Iraq War as a U.S. Marine in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was in Anbar Province. He left the Marine Corps in 2009, got his MFA from Hunter College. He has been writing and again, now has a collection of short stories. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I'm wondering, too, as a writer, whether you want to sort of wake up the readers to the fact that there are these people that went and served in war, a tiny, tiny percentage of the population. Some have referred to them as, you know, the one, we talk about the rich 1%.
Yeah.
This is the other 1% that actually has served. And whether, in a sense, there's a kind of frustration, which is to say, you know, read this, find out about us, talk to us.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I mentioned before, it's very strange to get out and be in a country that doesn't feel like it's at war, even though we are, and even though people are dying. And I think that, you know, as citizens, right, because ultimately it's on us as citizens. Whether, you know, if we're apathetic about the war, then it's our fault if the war is not prosecuted well. If we're invested in the war and think seriously about the policy, then it'll go better. I mean, I think the least that we owe the service members that we send overseas and the people in the countries that we're fighting in is very serious thought about the consequences of our foreign policy. And so, you know, and I think there's a lot of good work and a lot of, you know, people who are invested in it. And this book is part of my offering to that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
To ask people to step inside these heads and think about what these experiences feel like from the inside.
Do you think sometimes people tiptoe around veterans, you know, sort of afraid to ask them things or have certain kinds of conversations with them because, you know, they've served and we haven't?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's you know, there's a huge knowledge gap and then there's also just it's a sensitive subject, so it can be difficult to broach. It can be difficult on both sides. You know, the veteran might not want to talk or, you know, expose his experiences or his ideas to an audience that might not accept everything, every interpretation that he might want them to. And then, you know, likewise, I think civilians feel like maybe they don't have the right to talk. And yet I think that conversation is so important for us to have. I think it's important interpersonally so that, you know, people
we get
can,
to know each other.
Exactly.
Right?
And I also think that, you know, it's important for us as citizens as politically.
In fact, I keep referring to all these things that you've written, but I found them all so interesting. Is you wrote about something talking to a friend, I guess, who had been abused. So she had had a background of,
right.
of violence and abuse. And even she was sort of tiptoeing around saying, you know, I just can't know your experience.
Right. And it was very strange because my experience was fairly mild, right? And there's this sort of... And I talk a little bit in that piece about how, you know, a lot of war literature, particularly in America, there's this notion of, you know, the veteran who goes over and sees war and experiences the truth of reality, and then the civilian who doesn't understand. And I think that that's ultimately kind of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that we need to have those awkward conversations more.
Even if it makes us feel uncomfortable and
right.
awkward and
yes.
all those things.
Exactly.
Let me ask you about another story in this book. This one is called Prayer in the Furnace, and it's a chaplain's perspective on the war. And he has, I guess he's a Marine, a guy named Rodriguez, who you know keeps coming to him and confessing to him. And
mm-hmm.
I'm curious about whether there was a chaplain you had in mind, or I know you went to a Jesuit high school. Whether there was someone you were thinking about.
Well. It's always a lot of people that I'm thinking.
Maybe an
of.
Unfair question. I don't know.
I knew a lot of really great chaplains while I was in the military. A few who weren't so great, but for the mm-hmm. most part, really great chaplains. And but you know, as much as I was thinking about them, I was thinking about Georges Bernanos's Diary of a Country Priest. I was thinking about, you know, a lot of the literature that I'd read, Shusaku Endo's work, Graham Greene, even more. Just anybody who could enrich my understanding mm-hmm. of the kind of the way in which a priest, a religious person would grapple with these very difficult moral issues, right? I mean, the priest in that instance is a unit that is sort of that has lost restraint, that is caught in a very, you know, I talked about the morally bruising battlefield, and they're slipping, or at least that's what Rodriguez is worried about. That's why he goes to that chaplain,
right.
And so, you know, my general perspective on literature is, you know, I don't think I'm smart enough to think through these issues, but I can go through and read the smartest people who've ever thought about them, and then try and apply them to what I'm writing about and really try and explore it.
Rodriguez says to the chaplain, the only thing I want to do is kill Iraqis.
Mm.
Which, yeah, exactly. No.
And
everyone's an enemy now, it
well,
seems.
Yeah, that's a Lance Corporal who goes to him. Yeah. The it's just they're in such a violent circumstance. They're in constant threat, and it's just the intensity of the pressure of the environment, but then also their leadership is very aggressive and not really well equipped to push the men in the right direction. And so, you know, those Marines are in a very bad position, mm-hmm. both, you know, physically and just in terms of the level of threat, but also the stresses that they're being put under and the lack of guidance that they have.
He says, I see mostly normal men trying to do good, beaten down by the horror and describing what they're going through. And yet I have this sense that this place is holier than back home. Gluttonous, fat, oversexed, overconsuming, materialistic home where we're too lazy to see our own faults. At least Rodriguez has the decency to worry about hell.
Right.
That really knocked me out.
Well, you know, he's grappling right with the heart of the moral issues
right.
that are there. And, you know, as I said before, you know, those moral issues are just as pertinent for us as citizens, but they're more abstract.
Yeah, yeah. Let me get, looks like Brahman from Wilmington, Delaware, to join our conversation. Brahman, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, how you doing, everyone? Very, very compelling.
Thanks.
Especially today. as it always is on Radio Times.
Well, thank you, Brahman. Go ahead.
All right. Well, I called in because I'm listening to a lot of the experiences and a lot of the trauma that happens in the coping mechanisms, and always thinking to cross-reference it to what happens in the city. And as you know, I work with a lot of the, well, all of the adjudicated youth in Wilmington, Delaware, and help them to, you know, cope with reentry into the community and getting them to better themselves and suffice themselves as a positive community leaders. But I see a lot of the trauma, and we can even call it PTSD, and the coping mechanisms and the norms that are created are in the same circumstances as, similar circumstances as someone coming from a war zone, and they, you know, somebody they call, refer to cities as war zone.
Sure.
Go ahead.
No, that's all right, Brahman. Let me give our guests just a chance to respond to your comments, which is seeing some of the parallels between, you know, the war over there and the war in some of our cities.
Exactly. And actually, you know, there's a story in the book where I talk about that directly, where, you know, there's a story called After Action Report, where a Marine takes credit for another Marine's kill, and he's talking to his staff sergeant about it, and the staff sergeant says, "Well, you know, I'm from one of these towns in America where there's a lot of violence, and this is what it was like for me as a kid, and this is what it was like for my community." And I think it's a point that's very well taken, mm-hmm. because, you know, I think sometimes you think of war, people think of war as this, you know, very sort of abstract, out there thing. And yet a lot of the same issues and problems that, you know, that we need to face when we're thinking about the veteran experience certainly can be applied to the experiences that people have right here at home.
Yeah. Brahman, thanks for the call to Radio Times. He mentioned PTSD, and I've talked to Marines and soldiers. And I can't remember who it was, one of them saying back to me, you know, not everyone has PTSD. I mean, the idea that there's this sort of broad brush that has been painted of, mm-hmm. of all the
Absolutely.
Veterans coming home.
It's you know, it's very difficult because PTSD it's very real, it's very serious.
Absolutely.
And yet there's PTSD as you know, an incredibly serious condition that deserves all the research and support that we can muster for it. And then there's sort of the way that PTSD sometimes functions in the culture. And I feel like, you know, particularly sometimes I think it's a way of kind of boxing aside all these things that boxing off all these things that we don't want to talk about, or, you know, you're angry, you're sad, you're depressed, you're enraged about the, you know, the condition. Well, you know, maybe you have PTSD and you should, hopefully there's a pill for that.
Rather than
actually let's talk about, you know, maybe that's a rational response to some of the things that are going on.
And that's Phil Klei, our guest today on Radio Times, served in the Iraq War and also has written a new book, a collection of short stories called Redeployment, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
Dear God, what have you done to your fingernails?
I beg your pardon?
This diabolical varnish, the colour is completely wrong.
Oh, really? Don't you like it?
It's not that I don't like it. I am physically repulsed.
On the next Fresh Air, Wes Anderson talks about his new comedy, The Grand Budapest Hotel, starring Ralph Fiennes as the concierge of an elegant hotel in the late 1930s in an Eastern European city on the verge of war. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
What's your ultimate sleep number?
The last thing I want to do is live to my father's age and have the last 15 years in frailty and disability with Alzheimer's.
It's not numerical age, but the quality of life, however long, that should be our strategy on aging, a public health perspective on people living longer. Part of our conversation all week on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, Phil Klei is our guest. He served in Iraq during the height of the surge in Anbar province, came home in 2008, and like other veterans, worked to make sense of what he had experienced, and has turned to writing, to fiction. And he's got a new book, a collection of short stories called Redeployment. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I'd love to have you read another chapter from your book, this one titled Bodies.
All right. I'll just start from the opening. For a long time, I was angry. I didn't want to talk about Iraq, so I wouldn't tell anybody I'd been. And if people knew, if they pressed, I'd tell them lies. There was this Haji corpse, I'd say, lying in the sun. It'd been there for days. It was swollen with gases. The eyes were sockets. And we had to clean it off the streets. Then I'd look at my audience and size them up, see if they wanted me to keep going. You'd be surprised how many do. That's what I did, I'd say. I collected remains. U.S. forces mostly, but sometimes Iraqis, even insurgents. There are two ways to tell the story, funny or sad. Guys like it funny, with lots of gore and a grin on your face when you get to the end. Girls like it sad, with a thousand-yard stare out to the distance as you gaze on the horrors of war they can't quite see. Either way, it's the same story. This lieutenant colonel who's visiting the government center rolls up, sees two Marines maneuvering around a body bag, and decides he'll go show what a regular guy he is and help. As I tell the story, the lieutenant colonel's a large, arrogant bear of a man with fresh-pressed camis and a short, tight mustache. He's got huge hands, I'd say, and he comes up to us and says, "Here, Marine, let me help you with that." And without waiting for us to respond or warn him off, he reaches down and grabs the body bag. Then I describe how he launches up, as though he's doing a clean and jerk. He was strong, I'll give him that, I'd say. But the bag rips on the edge of the truck's back gate, and the skin of the Haji tears with it, a big jagged tear through the stomach. Rotting blood and fluid and organs slide out like groceries through the bottom of a wet paper bag. Human soup hits him right in the face, running down his mustache. If I'm telling the story sad, I can stop there. If I'm telling it funny, though, there's one more crucial bit, which Corporal G had done when he told the story to me for the first time, back in 2004. Before either of us had collected remains or knew what we were talking about. I don't know where G heard the story. The colonel screamed like a bitch, G had said, and then he'd made a weird, high-pitched keening noise deep in his throat like a wheezing dog. This was to show us precisely how bitches scream when covered in rotting human fluids. If you get the noise right, you get a laugh.
And again, Phil Klei reading the beginning of one of the stories in his new book, a collection of short stories called Redeployment. And just even that minute or two reading, I mean, it's obviously the horror of what is in this bag.
Right.
And the idea that the girls want it sad and boys want it funny. I guess should we be surprised by that?
Well, you know, he knows how to play his audience, and he knows that I think one of the things that you deal with when you come back is when you talk to people and they find out you're a veteran, especially because there's so few veterans. You know, I went to New York. I was often one of the few veterans people were interacting with. They have a lot of ideas about who you are and what you've been through. And he's highly conscious of that, and it bugs him, but he also sometimes plays off of it.
And tells lies.
And tells lies.
I mean, we don't even know if what he's telling us is true or not.
Right. Yeah, he's telling a story as if he was there and he wasn't. He doesn't know if it's true.
Let me get to Lance from Downingtown to join our conversation. Lance, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, ma'am. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And thank you for your service.
Thank you.
And my question is, I'm actually a chaplain in the military, and I'm preparing for deployment myself this summer, and I've noticed in the unit that I work in and other people I interact with, other veterans, there's just tremendous, tremendous amount of guilt. And I wish I could just say the magic words and use the right formula and have the guilt go away, but I'm just wondering through your experience and maybe into your writing, how would you help a person just process through that? What kind of, what would you tell me as a chaplain to help people going through this, just the overall guilt of actions they've taken?
I mean, you know.
Wow. It's a powerful question, Lance.
Yeah, it's a big question. It's a serious one. I think it's certainly a process. You know, the psychologist Jonathan Shea talked about this a little with, you know, Vietnam vets who, you know, sometimes he would send, if they were Catholic guys, to confession, but he made sure that he'd send them to a particular priest because he didn't want them to have some guy who'd say, oh, it's all okay, you were serving your country, don't worry about it, because I think the biggest thing is to take those feelings of guilt very seriously, even if it's a circumstance that the person can't control, and maybe, because it's for each individual, it's going to be very deeply felt and deeply personal and needs to be respected as such as they work through it. It's not, you know, as you said, it's not, there is no sort of magic wand that you can, that you can wave.
Lance, you said you're being deployed. Where are you going?
Over into not Afghanistan, but to Qatar.
Oh yeah,
it's a processing center, and so I'll be helping out process people and things like that. Apparently, but I noticed that just in my career, and then also I think in my deployment, I'll be faced a lot with that question. That just seems be something that I struggle with myself in helping people. But I appreciate your. Answering that, there's just I find myself in the trap of saying, "Okay, well, it was war, so everything's excusable."
Right.
Because what happened is what happened. There's you can't get around the actions that a person takes. So there's just I agree with you. There's just no easy answer. But I appreciate your answer and your encouragement, and I can't wait to read your book.
Well, Lance, I appreciate your question because I think it's really gets to the heart of so much of what we've been talking about.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you, thanks for the work that you do. I think it's really important.
Right. And you said thank you for your service. Yeah, thank you, Lance. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you like that? Thank you for your service.
I've always appreciated it when people say that. I know that there's a question some veterans talk about. I think not frustrated with people saying thank you for your service, since it's a nice sentiment, and certainly I think we signed up to serve. What I think sometimes people worry about is whether there's more behind that.
Right, there's sort of a knee jerk thing you say to somebody.
And whether there's that sort of serious thinking and engagement with what that service means.
Right.
But certainly, I've always appreciated it.
Again, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So many books, so many novels, short stories even, have been written about war. Were there certain ones that you read that sort of helped you to write this book?
Different ones for different stories, and as I said before, not always war books, right? I think one of the books that really kind of blew my mind when I first read it was Joseph Conrad's Lord Jim.
Yeah,
and it's not a war book really, but it certainly has so many insights into questions of duty and decisions made under stress and people living with the consequences of their actions and all sorts of other, and the way that sort of organizations work and sort of organizational ethics and systems of codes of behavior. Everything from, the good soldier Schveck, which is a great World War I novel, to, you know, I mentioned Georges Bernanos' Diary of a Country Priest. I mean, tons of books. I was always, for every story I was reading towards, you know, I read a Foreign Service officer's memoir, We Meant Well. I read Hard Lessons, which is the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction Report. And that is very much worth reading. And very eye-opening about sort of just going through the decisions that were made and the consequences and lessons that we should learn for the future.
You had a lot of readers. You thank them all at the end of your book. You had a lot of people reading to help you, I guess, as a writer, right?
It's having readers, you know, go through the work and show me my blind spots. That's the only way that I know how to do this, right? You know, every story was read you know, by at least, you know, my friend Chris Robinson, Lauren Holmes, Pat Blanchfield, Roy Scranton, my wife Jessica, and then my editor. And, you know, I had veteran readers who could help me out with veteran things. And then, you know, especially at Hunter MFA, I had really smart civilian readers who, as they got to know me, weren't mystified by the fact that I was a veteran, and they felt like they could call me out on my BS when
right.
I was and showing me things that I other blind spots that I had, and then, you know, it's just kind of a painful process of mortification and realizing how badly you've screwed up and how much deeper you need to dig.
This is writing, right?
This is writing, yeah, over and over again until you've gotten to something vital, the reason that you started writing the thing in the first place.
And you recognize that when you get there, saying, that, yeah. I realize, you know, you'll probably keep going on forever, but at some point you have to say, this is really what I want to say.
Right, and this is these are the characters and their and what they're going through.
Let me get Mark from Abington to join our conversation. Hi, Mark, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
It's very fortuitous that at the very time when Philadelphia, the One Book Program, is reading Kevin Powers' Yellow Birds, and I'm sure folks are familiar with that.
Yes.
He was here a year or so ago and questioned his faith in his chain of command and the whole purpose of his being there. Had you ever had that questioning for your being there or in your chain of command as far up as, as far up as it goes?
Thanks, Mark.
Well, you know, I actually worked for the people that I directly worked for. I thought were actually excellent leaders. I was for the most part lucky in that I got you know, I worked for sort of very smart, well-intentioned people. I also met bad leaders in the Marine Corps. I met mediocre leaders. It's an organization like any other. I think that. You know, one of the things that I wanted to deal with in the book, and certainly there's a story from the perspective of a Foreign Service officer, and he's kind of navigating, really trying to help reconstruct Iraq in the aftermath of a lot of policies that were very short-sighted. And certainly doing the research for this book, there's no way to look at, you know, what we did going into Iraq and say, like, oh yeah, that was you know, we did a bang up job. I think you had amazing work, you know, from a lot of lower level people, but if you know, if the people at the top are insisting that there's not going to be an insurgency, that we don't need to plan for one, you know, if there's gross waste, fraud, and abuse, if there's all these other things, if there's just this sort of basic lack of planning or even the willingness to include all, you know, other voices into the conversation for the planning process, then we shouldn't be surprised that a lot of those efforts were hamstrung. And so I think writing the book and thinking very seriously about the ways in which poor policies ended up affecting the experiences of the people that I write about, it was deeply, deeply enraging and deeply saddening.
Mark, thanks for the call to Radio Times. One of your stories begins with one of the characters saying, "I'm tired of telling war stories." Are you getting to that point?
Well,
are you done with war stories?
I don't know. I think that I think they're important to be told. What do I say about that story? You do come back and you end up you end up telling the same stories, or you have people who want you to fit into the same role, right? And you know, frequently depends on the political perspective of the person that you're talking to, right? You know, you'll either find people who, or just their general impressions of the military, and you'll find people who either want you to be, you know, the super Navy SEAL badass character who can, you know, kill you 37 ways with, you know, your pinky. Or, you know, the sort of passive, traumatized vet who is just, you know, victim of poor policy and an object of pity. And I think that the process of telling more stories, trying to tell them honestly, is an attempt to get past those sort of initial impressions and get to something deeper and more interesting and more true. Certainly, it doesn't... Telling war, it's war stories are not always the happiest of stories.
No.
I'll say that it's important. Obviously, it's important to me to tell them, and so I'm glad that I'm doing it.
Well, I'm glad you're doing it as well. We're almost out of time here, but you know, each chapter is a different character, a different story.
Yes.
Rather than one large story, that the multiple experiences of all these characters.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that was very important to me, to kind of break apart that experience so that you can see the variety, and also have different characters who interpret their experience differently. They feel about what they've been through and their role in it differently, and you can kind of compare them and make, you know, critical judgments yourself.
Well, Phil Clay, it's been a great pleasure, and thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, his collection of short stories is called Redeployment. And you can check us out. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out much more about this program. In fact, continue a conversation on our homepage. And you can check us out on Facebook, Twitter, email archives, and podcasts. And we did take a picture of our guests, so you can check them out as well. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.